Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. On today's episode, I have invited Roger Reynolds to join me. I met Roger on somebody else's podcast that I appeared on, and I really enjoyed speaking with him on that podcast. He's a very insightful, interesting fellow. He has a lot to talk about in terms of trauma and complex PTSD and his struggles in trying to come to terms with a very difficult childhood. And being a very sensitive man, he's devoted his life to trying to help people in the world of mental health and public speaking. And I'm going to leave it up to him to describe. Number one, Roger, welcome. There are two basic motivating forces, fear and love. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, excitement, and acceptance.
Coming to you from our studio in Santa Barbara, California, this is the Fear Me Out podcast. We're not your typical self-help program. Our show takes a deep dive into those psychological issues that affect us on a daily basis. We hope to shift your perspective and have you experiencing emotions differently. Now, Dr. Dana Saperstein.
If you could take a moment and just, again, begin describing your life, and we'll go from there.
Yep. All right. Thanks. Thank you, Dana. Glad to be here. So I'm Roger Reynolds. I'm in, Southwest Wisconsin, not too far from the Mississippi River. That's where I grew up, on a farm. We were about a mile in from the bluffs of the Mississippi River on a ridge. And my family, we tried to present as a quintessential Midwestern happy family, happy farm family. And then that was our public facade, and our private reality was quite different. My father was a binge drinking alcoholic, and he also was a very angry man, a very rageful man, had a lot of rage. And the rage and the control and the domination happened regardless whether he was sober or drunk, that could happen. And growing up on a farm, there's a lot of work to do. And as little kids on farms in this area, which is not real wealthy area, it's a poor area. And so kids start helping on the farm quite young. And with my dad, if he had to tell you how to do something, he was yelling at you and you were stupid. So it really, very early age, having to read him and read the situation and know the work that we were doing, or I was being yelled at. I have an older brother too.
Is it just you and your older brother?
Yes. And then it gets complicated.
Oh, okay.
So my mom worked off, and I'll come back to the family tree.
Okay.
So there's my brother, who's 2.5 years older, and myself to start with. And then my parents get divorced, and then some more comes in, which I'll explain as we go on in the story. My mom, she died a few years ago, and we'll eventually get back to that. But as she was sick, she told the story of one time I was a baby. I was probably 6 months or so old. My brother's 2.5 years older, so he'd have been roughly three. And that she and my dad had a fight. My dad drove out of the driveway, and she sat there in the living room holding me as an infant, my brother on the floor at her feet, and she's crying and I'm crying and my brother's crying. That's a really interesting story for me to hear near the end of her life, because I was afraid of my father's rage and afraid of my father. And my father, I call it no contact physical violence or no contact physical abuse. He would throw things, he would break things, he would punch things, but he didn't hit us. So there was violence. We knew it could be turned on us, but we were always in fear, but we didn't get hit. So it was harder to identify. And my mom, so there's the rage piece. And my mom, all of my life, she would have what it's really hard to describe these to people, but I call it short-term emotional breakdowns. And with if you grow up with someone who's predictably, who, like, I've talked to other people who survived families with abuse, and one woman told me, she's like, in a second, her father would just be raging. You couldn't even see it coming.
Right.
This is a very weird statement, but my father's rage was somewhat predictable and readable. So we learn to identify, for our own safety, his levels of getting angry, and try to, like, this is what I call submit and appease. It's like, shut down who I am and try to placate or appease him, and hopefully there gets to be less rage. At the other end of the spectrum of emotions, my mom's emotional breakdowns, I've tried to explain this to people, and the best I've come up with is to, and of course, my father had the most extreme, at times my father got to the most extreme extent of his rage, and at times my mom would get to the most extreme extent of her breakdown, of her emotional breakdown, her mini emotional breakdowns are short term. And those, what I've tried to come up with to explain to people, and I know there are other people out there who've lived with this, and there will be people listening to this who are like, oh my gosh, that's my household. That's my, what my caretaker, whomever, is what I try to get people to understand this is, imagine someone who just saw their pet or their child hit by a vehicle, and they're being raced to the hospital, and survival is uncertain.
Right.
And that parent is going to be inconsolable, is going to be shocked, inconsolable, wailing, scared. And my mom, from breaking a dish or spilling some food, could get to that level of inconsolability, of like upset, of she would go quiet, her body, her head would go down, her shoulders would go down. And I know this was happening before I have memories. But what I remember is, if we saw mom getting like that, we really would freeze. It was like, stop what you're doing. See if you can figure out what you're doing that could be upsetting mom, or just stop talking, stop doing, and see what happens with mom. And that was just as scary through my entire life. Like, so I, through my, into my adulthood, I tried not to upset my dad. Into my adulthood, I tried not to upset my mom. And upsetting her was breaking down. And there were times she would go into the bathroom and be wailing. And just like an inconsolable wailing that is really scary when you're 6, 10, 12 years old, that your mom is in this over broken dishes or over spilled food. Or one of the things that I've never figured out, my brother and I both like wordplay. And we would just do kind of free thought, goofy wordplay. And my mom couldn't handle it.
It sounds like almost anything set her off.
Right. So if I actually sat down and thought about it, I probably would have a list of like 175 things not to do around mom.
Well, so how do you live with that kind of volatility, number one? And how are you supposed to cope with that as a little kid without feeling incredibly anxious and responsible?
Yes. I just lived with it as a kid. I mean, as a kid, you know, like neither parent or primary caretaker is stable.
And did you feel a certain amount of shame as a result of accidentally setting her off in some way, or setting your father off in some way?
As a child, I don't think it would have been shame. I think it would have been fear.
Okay.
And I remember I talked to one of my therapists, and she's like, well, based on what you thought, you probably were like 6 or 7 based on the thought process. My birthday's in the middle of July.
Okay.
And had a birthday party. at our house, had some family over, grandma, grandpa, aunts and uncles, some cousins, and it's time for me to open my presents. And as I said, we didn't have a lot of money. I got presents, didn't get their little toys for kids. But I remember when I got done opening the presents, this thought went through my head of, oh no, it's over. It's over or it's done. And I didn't mean that there weren't more presents. And I actually talked through a therapist of like, what, like I've explored this as an adult. Like, what was I thinking? And what I was thinking, what was done was the peace and the quiet and maybe the focus on me in a peaceful, quiet way.
Oh, okay. So it sounds like you felt loved for a brief moment.
Right. Or it, if not loved, at least like calm.
Right. And so how did the family react to your mom when she had her outbursts?
So my parents divorced. They separated the summer that I was between first and second grade. They got back together.
Okay.
So that was when second grade. So like first, so I probably would have turned six that summer.
Yeah.
And they got back together. And then when I was in third or fourth grade, they divorced and did not get back together.
And do you understand what brought them to divorce?
Oh, yes. It's actually, I hear various people talk about their parents getting divorced and how hard that was, or how sad it was, or how they were upset. My most prominent memory of my parents' marriage is we had a two-story farmhouse, and we heated with wood stove that was in the basement. And so the upstairs wasn't real warm. And there was the stairway that went up from the kitchen. We could let the heat go up there. And so the bedroom at the top of the stairs, which the stairway opened into this bedroom, was the warmest bedroom upstairs. Okay. So in the winter, as little kids, my brother and I slept together in this bed, in this bedroom at the top of the stairs. And my most prominent memory of my parents' marriage, the one thing that happened the most, is waking up in the middle of the night when my father got home from the bar and hearing my mom and dad downstairs fighting, verbally fighting. And my brother and I, as little kids, 4, 5, 6 years old, we just laid in bed and listened to it. And there's nothing we could do, and we weren't going down there. And to this day, the house just recently, the farm just recently got sold a few years ago, but it was built in 1936, wooden doors. And the door to the upstairs off the kitchen has a dent bigger than a quarter in it, where in the 1970s, my father threw a cut glass crystal ashtray at my mom. Mm-hmm. And it hit the door, and there was a permanent dent in the door. There's another time where he punched a hole in the wall. There also, we had a 1970s big wooden table with big wooden turned spindle legs. And one morning, my brother and I remember waking up, and one of the legs of this table was broken, and dishes and everything was on the floor. In a fight, my father had broken this table.
Wow.
So so that's what I mean by no contact physical abuse. He's not hitting anyone, but everybody's scared.
Well, I will say that in my experience, you don't actually have to be the object of violence in order to suffer from post-traumatic stress. I mean, there are so many first responders, as an example, who come upon an accident and they suffer as much post-traumatic stress having to clean up as the person that was in the accident itself. So I could really imagine that the intensity of the emotional, both the breakdowns of your mom and the anger of your father, could send a really sensitive kid like yourself into almost a constant state of panic all the time. Am I being fair in describing the situation that way?
You're being very fair, and I'm going to take it a little bit farther to what I actually think was going on with me. But yes, absolutely. Early on, absolutely would have been in a state of panic, in a state of fear. And so when my parents divorced, it was a relief. The house got quieter.
Right.
to that. I just gave you a little buildup to me to explain, like, when they got divorced, my mom and my brother and I moved to a different place. It was, although I didn't put words to it at that time, like, it was a relief. Like, life was calmer. Life was safer.
And did you go and spend time with your dad after that? Or
we did. Yep, we did. He did have visitation. And through that summer, we saw him some. And I remember we had a beagle dog and like a puppy. And that was part of, that was, you know, kids, little kids, what do you remember? And this, so we moved like 30 miles away from where we lived on the farm. And before, so I understand the abuse cycle and the, you know, there's the calmness and then it starts to build up the tension and then there's the blow up and then there's the honeymoon phase. Yeah. Well, I'm sure before my parents separated, my dad got my brother and I a little beagle puppy.
Oh, okay.
I am sure that was in a honeymoon phase of his abuse cycle.
Right, right.
Tried to make amends. Yep, exactly. So when we moved, the beagle puppy came with us, and now it's probably 4 to 6 months old. I don't know. It's somewhere between 6 months and a year old. So where we moved to, we kept it tied up for a few weeks so I'd get used to it. And when we let it go, it disappeared.
Oh.
And 2 to 3 weeks later, it showed up back at the farm where my dad was.
Oh my God. It traveled 30 miles to go back.
Oh. And crossed a major river, not the Mississippi, but crossed the Kickapoo River.
That's wild.
Yeah, isn't that? Yeah, the miracle of these animals.
Yeah.
So part of as a little kid, one of the memories I have of that summer is that like our dog got lost, our dog showed up at dad's.
Wow. That's wild.
Yeah.
So what were your adolescent years like for you after your parents separated or divorced? Right.
And remind me, as we get into my adulthood a little bit, I'll come back to the panic, because that panic and that fear of how they behaved, well, I actually figured it out. In 2014, I was finally accurately diagnosed with PTSD.
Okay.
And I've been with the same therapist since then. And a couple years into seeing him, I told him, I said, I do something. I'd had a fairly significant fight with my partner. And I said, I'm aware of things enough now that I can watch and I can describe what I did in this verbal argument with my partner. And I said, I stopped feeling me. I just turned off. I was initially afraid and engaged in the argument. And then I just turned off feeling me. And I looked at my partner, but I didn't look him in the eyes. I looked at his shoulder and my vision was blurry on the side. And I was really focused on him. And I was trying to figure out, what do I do to calm him down?
So you went back to feeling that same feeling that you did as a little kid.
And so this is what I described to my therapist as, I submit and then appease. Right. And what I would add to that submitting, and Pete Walker describes it as a fawn response now. What I would describe, and there's other people talking about this now, and they talk about it differently, and I'm sure it happens for different people, but what I would say I do in that, I'm sure as a toddler and as a 3-4-year-old, I did have panic with my parents. But with my father, when he was raging as a toddler, as particularly as 3 to 5 years old, if I would have fought back, that would have just gotten me hit, kicked, something. Right. If I had tried to run away, I would have gotten chased down, kicked, and brought back.
Right.
If I had froze, didn't speak, or fell down crying, that would have gotten me hit, kicked, and told to get back to doing work. So fight, flight and freeze were not options. And so, and there also was with my family, both my, particularly with my dad, was like, don't cry or I'll give you something to cry about. Don't look scared. So literally my father demanded that I now looking back, I can understand this. I just did it at the time, but looking scared in front of him would not have been acceptable, although it was justified.
Okay. So those are almost all the options available. What do you do when?
So that's where the fawn response or submit and appease comes in is I literally, and this is, we hear about multiple personality disorder or dissociative identity disorder, but there's many ways, and you can explain this more if you want. There's many ways to dissociate. And I would disconnect from, because the only way to not have fear on your face show is to not be aware that you're feeling it.
Right, just to disappear.
And so I would disconnect from that emotion so that it didn't show. And so I would be emotionally numb.
Right.
And then could continue to be engaged in helping him do the work on the farm.
So, Roger, do you feel like in the course of the therapy that you've done that you've been able to kind of thaw yourself out a little bit, having to do with being present in a relationship?
Yes. So I'm thawing an onion. That's frozen solid to the middle. But no, there was emotions. But it's one of the, so being triggered, and this is another piece of flashbacks, is I don't have flashbacks of visually thinking that I'm there on the farm with my dad. But I have emotional flashbacks. I have behavior flashbacks where I am immediately, without thought, doing the behaviors that helped me survive in my family.
Right. Which again, for people to understand that post-traumatic stress happens because you it's not safe to feel what it is that's happening to you. So you find a way to disconnect from it, but those feelings don't ever go anywhere. They still live inside your body. And so when people get triggered, it takes them back to whatever age they were when the trauma took place, and then the feelings are waiting there for you.
Yeah. And the therapist, the primary therapist that I've been seeing since 2014, is a PhD psychologist and was doing fMRI brain research before he went into therapy or being a therapist full time. And okay. So I like to jokingly say to him, I've been beat over the head with neuroplasticity.
That's very funny.
Yes, thank you.
But at least you have a sense of humor about it, and it sounds as though it's helping a great deal.
Yes. And so I one time asked him, because as I was starting to understand my triggers and understand that, like, there's a lot of symptoms to PTSD besides nightmares and flashbacks.
Right.
And as I start to understand those, and I talking with him about, like, that shutdown, that going into that submit and appease response with my partner, I would have done that with my dad. I would have done that with my mom. I asked him one time, and I like math. And I came in one time and I said, so are triggers and neural pathways like algebra equations?
Oh, that's an interesting way to look at it.
And he's like, what do you mean? And I said, this is what I mean. Growing up as my childhood, my dad got angry. That meant shut down and do what will make him happy.
That's a mathematical equation right there.
Exactly. And I said, but now it's not my dad's anger. It was somebody angry at work. It was somebody angry in a social situation. It was my partner getting angry. I still go into submit and I still get afraid and then go into submit and appease. And he said, yes, it's a neural pathway in your brain that gets generalized.
Right. That makes a great deal of sense. I'm glad you're talking about this because, again, I think that the classic explanation and understanding of post-traumatic stress is that it only occurs in wartime situations or really drastic, violent or other type situations. And that's not true. I think that the in some ways, the most serious post-traumatic stress that I see is daily hypervigilance, daily having to manage the people that brought you into the world in order to try to find a way to feel safe.
Yeah. Yep.
And because you end up not being able to be connected to yourself. You're too busy trying to put out the fires all the time. And the people around you are acting like it's normal.
Right. And, absolutely.
And it's not at all. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yep. And and just to add one more word to what you just said, and those people are civilians, not veterans.
Right.
The people with PTSD. Yeah,
but again, you are a veteran in a different sort of a way.
Yes, right.
Maybe you weren't enlisted in the service, but you were certainly as a child enlisted into the army of your family. And
yes.
And you were the point man, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Yep. Yep. And grew up in a war zone.
Right.
I just didn't know it was a war zone.
Well, I mean, and again, I think that when you grew up, especially in the rural type of an area, what was your closest neighbor when you were living on the farm?
Probably each way about half a mile.
Okay. And when you went to school, was it a place where mostly kids that grew up on farms went to school?
Yep. So I went to the same school. So when my parents separated the first time, my mom, my brother, and I moved away.
Okay.
Then we moved back and they got together for a couple years. And then when they divorced, my mom was financially and work-wise more stable than my father. And she kept the farm and bought my father out. And so he moved off the farm. And then my mother, my brother, and I stayed on the family farm.
Oh, that's interesting. Wow.
Yeah. Well, he was not as a binge drinking alcoholic, messed up.
Yeah,
he was. My mom was more stable than my father,
which is saying something,
right? And yet she does not get a Gold Star Stability Award.
No, I was going to say she was not exactly the queen of stability. That's for sure.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
But she was more stable, and she did keep a job. She did keep financial stability, and I give her credit for that. And she did do that. And yet when she came home from work, and she's recovering from the relationship with my father too, and her childhood, but when she came home from work most days, she came home and went to sleep for a couple hours, for an hour or two. And then we got up and had food, and we did have food. We did have a garden. We raised a lot of our own food, and we did raise some of our own meat, or we would have bought it from neighbors who raised animals for butchering. And so we always had food, but we didn't always have stability. We didn't have a present caretaker.
Right. Yeah. So again, Roger, what about your adolescence? Because I would be assuming that that was a time of turmoil in a different way.
Yep. So here I'll explain the rest of the family tree. Is my father married a woman who had two when in 79. So I was 11. My father remarried to a woman who had two boys from a previous marriage that were younger than me. So I have two stepbrothers. And then they remarried in 78 when I was 10. In 79, they had a daughter. So I now have one half sister.
Wow.
And in 79, my mom remarries to a man who doesn't have any children, hasn't been married before. And then in 1981, they have a daughter. And so, right. See why I paused before? Yes. I was like, wait.
Wow. So you have half siblings that are quite a bit younger.
I have two half sisters, who one is 11 years younger on my dad's side, and the other is 13 years younger on my mom's side.
Wow. Are they a part of your life at this point?
We'll get to that.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah, right. Not trying to rush.
Yeah, right. Sadly, there, the one might be she's disappeared for a while, which happens. They didn't have childhoods any better than mine.
Oh, and okay.
So they're also not real stable adults.
Okay.
So they have their own struggles. But as we get to farther down, then the story will, I'll explain some of those family dynamics that come to the end of their paths. But so in my adolescence, I lived with my mom and stepdad and older brother. And this baby was born, the sister was born, half sister was born when I was 13 years old. And I'd always liked kids. I liked babies. I had babysat. On a farm, there was my older brother, my stepdad. My stepdad was not a drinker like my dad, but he didn't know how to show love to my brother and I. And we were workers on the farm, and he maybe cared for us, but it didn't come out. And there was lots of fighting, and there was lots of fighting between him and me and my brother and him. And my brother hoped that sometime my stepdad would lose his temper and hit my brother so that we could go to the courts and get to go live with my dad.
Oh, okay.
So that tells you. And there was one big fight between my brother and stepdad where they were both working in the barn milking cows, and it's stone or concrete walls in the lower part of the barn where the cows are being milked. And my stepdad had my brother pushed up against the wall with his hand around his neck and his fist pulled back. Wow. And I was standing outside the barn in the yard where the cattle would be let out to watching this. And he didn't hit my brother, but he was that close.
Right.
And so it was, we had chores on the farm. Well, with my brother getting older and my stepdad being sober and working hard on the farm, my chores were more helping my mom. And one of my chores was helping with the baby, mm-hmm. as well as cooking and cleaning and helping in the garden and those kind of things. And so at 6 months of age, well, at 6 weeks, my mom went back to work after the baby was born. But when the baby was 6 months old, she came in her crib into my bedroom.
Wow. Now,
and she was my responsibility through the night. Comments?
Well, I can only say that, I mean, you've been an adult since you were born.
Yes. Yep. Yes.
And that's really what it comes down to.
It does. Exactly. And so she came in at 6 months old. By then she was probably mostly sleeping through the night, but she could need a diaper change or she could need a drink or something. And that was my responsibility. So I moved out from living with my mom and stepdad to go to live with my dad and stepmom the summer I turned 16, which she would have turned three. So for the next 2 years, for almost the next 2 years, she was my responsibility through the night.
Wow.
Drinks, diaper changes, potty training, all of that.
Wow.
And there were, so I was, my brother's 2 years older than me. So by the time that I'm 14, he's 16 and has a car and has a driver's license. And so we might go to the local school and small community. My class was 36 people. So it's a very small class compared to large urban schools. So going up to some of the social things to do was to like go up to sport events at the school. And so we would go up like during the week were girls' basketball games. And my brother would go up to them, and I'm gay. I was not out at the time. I graduated in 1986. I'm born in 68. So in the early 80s, I was called gay or called a fag at school sometimes, but not a lot, but I wasn't accepting that I was gay yet. But when I went, if I wanted to go with my brother up to school to do something like go to a girls' basketball game during the week, I had to take my little 1 to 2 year old sister with me.
Wow.
So I was her primary caretaker.
That's just so stunning at such a young age.
Yeah. And when we went to family events, I had to take care of her usually. When we went to a store, like a department store shopping, I had to take her as 14, 15 year old boy, I had to take my 1 to 2 year old, 2.5 year old sister with me in the store, and we would get into a store and I knew what was going to happen. And I would say to my parent, to my mom and stuff, like, I don't want to take her. I don't want to take her. And they're like, no, you have to take her. And looking back, here's another piece of, I can now laugh at this situation is, but at the time it was not funny to me. And I also feel bad for my little sister there being like a pawn of nobody wants you. That wasn't good for her, but I wasn't mine to take care of. So we would get into a store. They would say, you have to take your sister. I would say, I don't want to take my sister. We'll go back and forth a little bit. And they would say, you have to take her because she behaves better with you than she does with us.
Oh, God. Okay.
Yeah.
That's nuts.
And well, it was true.
I don't doubt it was true, but because you're a kind-hearted man.
Yes, exactly. And my humor, looking back at that now, is, okay, you're right. She behaves better with me than she does with you. That doesn't mean you have me parent her. That means you ask me for parenting advice.
Exactly.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. So into my adolescence, I was taking care of her. And now you're a psychologist, so you will understand this language, but I eventually, for a reason that I won't go into, I eventually got some of my psychological records, and I was reading through them. And when I read something by the psychiatrist that diagnosed me with PTSD, I was like, that is really weird wording. So I had to give my family history, and I'm looking through the notes, and I know what my family history is, and I'll reveal it to you in a minute, I'm having joy in my voice, and I probably shouldn't, because this is actually really tragic. But it also is, it's just a part of your life. And so there was a phrase in there that said I had an impressive family history.
Okay.
And it was written by the area that said, in 1960, my mom's brother died by suicide. In 1968, I'm born. In 1970, my mom's mom dies by suicide. And in 1997, at 75 years old, my mom's dad dies by suicide.
Oh, that's a lot of people taking their life.
In one nuclear family. The first three people to die in the nuclear family all died by suicide.
Huh.
Which, you know, I don't know. I don't, you probably know more than I do about like what's happening with identifying genes. But obviously something's going on. And absolutely, I know that there was abuse and trauma in my mom's family too.
Right.
But so it was weird to me when I read this phrase that says impressive family history. I'm like, that isn't really that impressive. But it's like, it means something different to a psychiatrist than it means to a layperson.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, different way of looking at things, that's for sure.
Yes. So why I bring that up is I know the events of my family history. I know of these suicides. And at 10 or 11, I started to think about killing myself.
So so you started having suicidal thoughts also?
I started having suicidal thoughts at 10 or 11. I know by 12 or 13, they were weekly to daily.
Wow.
And that continued until my early 50s.
Did you say early
50s? For 4 decades.
Whoa, that's wild.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. And have they since dissipated a bit?
They've dissipated a lot.
Okay.
And we'll get there. I don't know. Do you want to take the progression of my life, or do you want to hear how that happened?
Well, I just want to be mindful that we have about 20 minutes left. So gotcha. I want to make sure we cover everything that we need to in that period of time.
Yes. So
I would really love for you to talk about post about complex PTSD in the course of our conversation.
Yeah. So we'll jump forward to this in this. So I'll tell one story about the suicidal part. Is I was either a freshman or sophomore in high school, and in a small community, we all, you know, people are related to each other, and you know who those relations are. And so I had on my mom's side a second cousin who was my classmate.
Okay.
And so her dad was my mom's first cousin, and she and I were close friends, and I at some point talked to her about thinking of killing myself.
Oh, okay.
Freshman or sophomore in high school. She went home and, well, so I knew that I did that. Well, within the next week, I'm at home with my mom. It's the evening. I don't know if there was a basketball game that night or the night before, but anyway, it's just my mom and I in the kitchen. And my mom says to me, at the basketball game the other night, and I'm not going to use their names, at the basketball game the other night, my first cousin, your classmate's dad, came up and said something to me. And I'm like, okay. She's like, he told me that you told his daughter, your classmate, that you were thinking of killing yourself. And I'm like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
And she says, that is something you don't tell people.
So she wasn't concerned that you might have been suicidal. She was concerned you said something about it?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Another example of your mom's fine parenting skills.
Yes, exactly. Yep. And that was the end of the conversation.
And so you've just lived with it for all these years.
Yes. Yep.
Although you have sought help. Obviously.
I have sought help. And at 20 years old, I saw the first therapist and then saw therapist on and off. And so to jump forward to finally getting diagnosed in 2014 with PTSD, it was actually at a peer-led mental health support group that I was talking about something that happened in my life. And one of the other people in the support group with no professional said, I think you have PTSD. Wow. And I'm like, I don't have PTSD. I don't have nightmares. I don't have flashbacks. And she's like, talk to your therapist. I think you have PTSD.
Yeah.
And she was right. And so it's that has changed my life. And actually, so finally got accurately diagnosed, got a psychiatrist that was working with me, got a therapist that was working with me. And actually, like the form, the questionnaire for at that time in 2014 for the questionnaire from the DSM was the PCL-C for civilians. It's the PTSD checklist for civilians, 17 questions. There's 17 different major symptoms, not just nightmares and flashbacks. Right. And I scored really high on that.
Yeah. Okay.
And one of the things of these questionnaires, if people look at them, if people get them from the therapist, it is really important to, if you're working with a therapist, to like talk about those questions. And a lot of times they're just like given to us quickly and not talked about. But 2 years after being accurately diagnosed, there's one question on there on that one that said, do you have thoughts that your life will be cut short? And I always answered no. And 2 years into seeing the therapist, after being accurately diagnosed, I said, I need to ask you about this question. And I said, I don't have any thoughts of my life being cut short because I have no thought about my life into the future.
Right, right.
And actually, we're talking about suicide. Actually, because of the history of suicide in my family, and me being a sensitive caretaking person, I had actually sketched out in the calendar year the two times there were what periods of times were close to someone's birthdays, what periods of times were close to someone's or to major holidays. And in the calendar year, I had two windows where I could kill myself and it not be really close to someone's birthday or a major holiday.
Wow.
And the only thing I thought about going forward in my life was, if I don't kill myself in this time at this window, I have to live six more months. What might happen in that six more months?
Oh, okay.
That was the only thing I thought about of my life going forward.
Wow.
And when I explained that to my therapist, and I'm going to break a little bit here, he said, Roger, you're more severe than that question ever meant to ask.
Right.
And you are a 5, not a 0.
I am so sorry.
Thanks.
It must have been heartbreaking.
Well, it was heartbreaking. Well, no.
And relieving.
The 35 years before that were heartbreaking.
Yes. Yeah.
The like finally getting understood.
Right.
Finally talking, finally explaining, finally having somebody not tell me not to talk about this.
Right.
Was the opposite of heartbreaking.
Right. So you got some relief.
Yeah.
Is this part of why you've decided to devote your life to the care of others?
Yes, exactly. Right. So it's an interesting, right. It is a piece because, yes, a part of me hopes that I can help people suffer fewer years than I suffered.
Right, right.
And what happened that got my suicidal ideation to go down was this bizarre twist of events and a major crisis. My father died in 2010. I never had much to do with. I saw him a few times in my life and not I saw him a few times a year in my life and not a lot. Kept it at that, and that was fine. And I was around when he was dying for a little bit, but then I walked away because I was fighting with my aunt. But in 2018, the end of September, my mom went to the hospital. She'd been having abdominal problems through the summer. And she went in again. Turned out the next day they confirmed she had colon cancer. And then that was a Monday. And Wednesday they did a major surgery, took out a foot of her colon, a softball-sized mass. That was Wednesday. The next Monday she's released. It's already gone to her liver. So she's stage 4. Don't know for sure. Don't have the prognosis, but it doesn't look good.
Right.
That baby who I was the primary caretaker of, she lived in the city where my mom had the surgery where there's a major hospital. So when my mom was released, she stayed that first night with my sister. And then the next day came home Tuesday, a week and a half after she went in the hospital. And that Friday, her husband dies unexpectedly.
Whoa.
So we have a highly dysfunctional family in major crises.
Right.
My partner and I get to my mom's place that night. She lives about an hour away. And we're prepared to spend the night. We take stuff with us. We drove separately because we're different places. We get there. And from Friday, Saturday, Sunday, we take care of my mom, spend the night, and the baby, the 5-month-old baby stays too, which was fine. And I'm good at taking care of babies, and so is my partner. And Monday, my sister takes her baby back to stay with her through the night, which is fine. Tuesday afternoon, now we're there. I have had 4 years of therapy, and I now know that I'm emotionally shut down, but I'm aware that I'm emotionally shut down.
Okay.
It's major crises. And so I'm there to help the family. I'm the emotional support person. My brother and sister are there, but they're helping pick corn, move machinery around, do things on the farm. I'm the emotional support person to my mom in the family. I'm the emotional support person in the family, and I'm supporting mom. And Tuesday afternoon, my mom takes my partner Ernie aside and tells him, now this is 2018, tells him, in 1984, when Roger was 16 and moved out of my house to go live with his abusive dad, I told Roger, She said, I know Roger left because he didn't get along with my husband. And I told Roger if he couldn't respect, which really meant submit, to my husband, he had no place in my house or my family. And then when Roger chose to move, he really broke his little sister's heart. And
oh boy.
That night when we go, now this is 34 years earlier.
Right.
So that night when we go to bed, Ernie, my partner, tells me that your mom took me aside and told me these things. I'm like, what was her point? He's like, I have no idea. I'm like, so then I go into normal trying to mind read my family. And I'm like, what did she say before? What did she say after? What was her tone? Blah, 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 blah. He's like, I don't know. And so the next morning, I'm now healed enough that I talk to my partner and I'm like, we're leaving.
Okay.
I'm not saying anything. We're just leaving. Like, I can't confront her, can't ask her about it. She'll have a meltdown, but I no longer have to stay here and do this.
So you took your life back.
I took my life back. And another thing, I'll jump forward. So she ends up dying. I stayed a little bit connected. Another thing happened and I totally cut off the last 2 months of my mom's life. I didn't see her. And 10 days before she died, she took me out of her will.
Oh, okay.
Which for the first 1 to 2 years was really upsetting to me. And I'm working on a book about this. And I now can look at it with healing and say it is the best gift she ever gave me. Because she confirmed that I was never an equal member of this family.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
Yep.
So with a little bit of time that we have left, Roger, I want you to talk about the cool things that you're working on and what your projects are, because I really want you to promote the stuff you're doing.
Yep. I will do that. So what reduced my suicidality, and I'll do this really quickly, is my mom dying.
Right.
And finding out that I was the scapegoat and these other family secrets that got exposed. And I realized until my until 50, I always felt I was imagining things are crazy. Right. And she put it in writing, and she put it in writing with a lawyer. So she was really convicted to that I was not an equal member of this family. And that confirmation
set you free.
Set me free. Exactly. So it is the greatest gift. And over the next couple of years of that healing, my suicidality is almost gone.
I'm so glad to hear that. And it sounds like it was a really important moment for you.
Yes. And I have a really dark joke about this, that in complex PTSD groups on Facebook and stuff, this joke works. Every now and then someone's like, oh, my abuser's dying or my parents died or whatever. Right. And they're like, people tell me I have to reconnect with them and I'm going to have regrets. And I say, I walked away from my dad when he was dying. I walked away from my mom when she was dying. The only regret is they didn't do their part sooner.
That's well said.
Yes. So very dark humor, but it is the truth of growing up with neglectful and abusive families.
Oh, absolutely.
Yep. And one piece. So the work I'm doing, I'm working on a book that is titled, it's about this year in the life of chaos with my family. And then my next couple of years of healing, that book I hope to have out this winter. And its title is The Scapegoat Escapes. Carrying the elephant in the room.
Beautiful. I like that. It's great. Yeah. And will this book be published by a publishing house, or will you self-publish it?
I will self-publish. It'll be on Amazon and print on demand.
Well, I want to ask you to please get a hold of me so I can announce it on my podcast.
I would be glad to. And I will, it will always be at a low price, because I want to do public speaking and see what I get paid for that. But the book and a lot of workshops and stuff that I'm working on, I want them to be really available to people at low price. And so they'll always be at a low price.
So what's the best way for people to reach you, Roger, if they want to participate in what it is that you have to offer?
Yeah. So the best way, right. So let me mention a couple of things and then I'll say how to contact me.
And, okay.
So I'm also working on a book that has gotten moved to the front of the line about mindfulness in nature. And it's going to be little simple exercises to do, being out in nature, but a simple exercises. One of the things people with trauma, we sometimes mindfulness can be very risky for us. And because we live our lives trying to push down our demons and our memories. And right. If you ask us to quiet our mind, then they come up.
Yes.
And I credit mindfulness with, the foundation of my mental health healing, but I have to do it differently than just sitting on a pillow or doing a 10 to 20 or 30 minute thing. I have to do little active things, mindfulness moving, or like one of the things that I came up with that I like is like observing a leaf and like looking at it visually, looking at it, touching it, and then seeing if it has any smell, if it makes any sound, and then slowly just ripping it into little bitty pieces, piece by piece, is a meditation that I can do, a mindfulness thing. It's with nature. And like, there's no goal because you can't rip up a leaf wrong. And yet it like gets you involved and engrossed. And that's helped me learn to watch my thoughts and my emotions to do that. So I'm working on that book. That will hopefully be out. That book will hopefully be out the end of summer, early fall.
Oh, good. Okay.
And it'll be a lot of descriptions of little practices like that to do.
Okay. Very good.
And then the other thing that I've been doing is working to become a public speaker. And through the pandemic, I did some. I have a YouTube channel.
Okay.
And going back, I titled the YouTube channel based off of the no contact physical violence. And so a phrase that I really like that I came up with is no bruises on the outside.
Right. Okay.
And so my YouTube channel is titled No Bruises on the Outside.
So that's the best way for people to access us on YouTube.
Right. And I'm starting to put more videos up there again. I put some up and yes, to look at that. And then I have a Gmail account that if people want to get in touch, they can email me. And that Gmail account is, it's taken off of No Bruises on the Outside. So it's NOBOTO Roger.
And it's R-O-D or R-O-G-E-R.
R-O-G-E-R. Thank you.
I know that's how you spell it. I just wanted to make sure that, because there are two ways to spell your name.
Exactly.
I don't want people to do it the wrong way.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. I forget about that. Yeah. So yeah, NOBOTO for No Bruises on the Outside, Roger at gmail.com.
Very good.
And one of the other things that I'm working on as a gay man is I know there are a lot of people in the gay community or the queer community who live with complex PTSD.
Right.
And some of them probably, many of them, particularly people 50 to 80, 90 years old, probably don't even realize it, or many don't know about it.
Oh, I know that's true. Yes.
Yes. And so I want to start doing video conference workshops in any place that speaks English, because I don't know another language, and to organize a video conference workshop to just do an introductory information talk about complex PTSD in the queer community.
Wow, that's very cool.
Thank you.
You know, Roger, you are an incredibly inspirational man. The fact that you come from such a difficult background and were kind of forced into adulthood at such an early age, meeting you and seeing you, at least on Zoom, you are young at heart, that's for sure.
Thank you.
It's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Do you have any final words that you want to give to my audience before we go today?
I lived without hope for four decades.
Right.
And it took a lot of therapy and some major family changes. And after four decades of intense suicidal ideation, I'm living a much better life.
Right.
So
your courage prevailed.
So after 40 years of living without hope, I now have hope.
That is just, you couldn't have said it better. Thank you so much.
We appreciate our listeners and are interested in your comments and suggestions. Feel free to email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. If you are interested in becoming a sponsor for this podcast, please email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. See you next time.